Hi there. Welcome to the right side of zero. Thank you very much for being here. If it's your first time here, please press the link to the subscribe button. It's the best way to support this podcast. So today we're doing the summary for the week of the 8th of January. We started the week talking about Ezra Klein. He interviews Gloria Mark from the University of California, Irvine. She has a book out called Attention Span. They talk about how we are normalizing bad behavior. For example, she talks about a mother who gets to the supermarket and hands an electronic pad to the kid to keep him distracted. And then he also mentions a mother who ignores her kid who is asking repeatedly for her attention with a question, the same question. He's looking for an answer, but her attention is devoted to the cell phone and she just ignores her kid who's just begging for her attention. And you know, by giving kids technology to keep them distracted so that we can go on with our lives, it's bad behavior, and we're normalizing it because we're saying it's okay to keep you distracted with this technology. It's okay for us to create distance with the technology. Or even worse, in the case of the kid who's asking for attention, it's an opportunity to be involved with your kids. You're saying my time with the cell phone, my time being distracted, is more important than interacting with you or giving you my attention. And I would like to point out that giving someone attention, giving someone of your time, is the greatest thing you could do for someone, because your most valuable possession is your life, and your life is a moment, the moment that you have right now, and whatever you choose to do with that moment is what you're choosing to do with your life. Your most precious thing is your life. So whatever you're doing in this moment is the most precious thing you can do. And so giving attention to your kids is saying, this is the most precious thing I can do, is spend time with you. It's giving you part of my time, giving you part of my life to be with you. And if we start saying, look, my time is best spent, my life is best spent on social media or just scrolling through a cell phone, or telling you that your time and your life is best spent on an electronic device instead of sharing your time with me or sharing our time together, that's normalizing something that's wrong. Anyway, something I thought while listening to the podcast is that part of the reason, like, they mentioned something about when you're reading and you have to read the sentence over and over because it's just, it's not making sense. So you go back over and you read it again and you read it again, trying to make sense of what you're reading, is that you've exhausted your energies and you're unable to pay attention. If you take a break, and there are many ways to take a break, and they say the best way is to go for a walk in nature, but sometimes we can't find a park or we can't find the shade of a tree or just step outside, especially if you're at work. But once you do and you come back, then you see, you read the sentence and it makes sense because you've repleted your energies and you're able to focus again and you're able to pay attention to what you're doing. And they say when you do that cooler, water cooler talk, you're also disconnecting. You're allowing your system to relax. You're recharging. You're allowing your mind to relax. And when you come back to your work, you're able to pay attention and to focus again. But what I thought about that, and they say that some people actually do some stretches and some people do some short meditations, but water cooler talk helps, and the best thing you could do is go for a walk in nature. But when I thought about that, is I think that kids sometimes, like, they need to hear this, because when they're doing schoolwork, and sometimes they have to read over a sentence over and over, and they just can't get it. They might think they're challenged, or they lack the smarts or the brilliance or the intelligence of other kids. But the fact is that they need to recharge. They need a break. They need to take a breather, just disconnect from the homework or whatever work you're doing in school, and then come back to it and realize, oh, look, I read the sentence and it makes sense. So I just thought about that. I guess I had that experience at some point in time. Then the next day I did commentaries on the Andrew Huberman podcast. He went solo this time around, and he was talking all about viruses, the cold virus versus the flu virus, and how the cold virus only lasts 2 hours on any surface, while the flu virus will last up to 24 hours. He also mentions that people have the wrong impression that the virus is contagious when you have the symptoms. And he says that's wrong, that you're actually contagious up to 24 hours before any symptoms are manifest. So you might be infected with a virus, you might have a virus, a cold or a flu virus, without any symptoms, and you're going around and people could actually catch it. The best thing you can do is take a rest, take a break, avoid doing exercises or working out. You should allow your body to do what it has to do. He talks, remember, I always leave the links to the different podcasts so you can go check them out. And he says, he speaks wonderfully about the immune system and how it's all the time, it's defeating these viruses, and we just keep going about our lives without getting a cold or a flu. Every once in a while, we might have a weak immune system for one reason or another, and we might actually allow a cold virus or a flu virus to take hold. But anyway, our system, our immune system, will defeat it. He talks about how the skin is the first layer that helps us, and he says there are breaks within the skin, and he's referring to like the eyelids, the mouth, the ears, and how there are holes in the skin that allow things to go into the body. But he says that the nose, it's, you know, wonderful defeating viruses. It heats them up and it defeats them right away. We mostly take viruses in through the mouth or through the eyes. And it happens a lot because we take our hands to our face all the time. And we do this because it's something we have inherited. It's a behavior we've inherited throughout time. Somehow we're like sensing things with our hands and bringing it to our face to help us interpret it, how it feels, how it tastes, how it smells. And by bringing our hands to our face, we're bringing things to these openings in the skin, the eyes and the mouth and the nose, and we might actually allow a virus to come in. But the mouth, the nose, and the eyes are also protecting us against viruses. They say when you wake up with these secretions in the eyes that harden up, that's our eyes working to defeat viruses and being successful at it. Okay, so the next day I talk about Ezra Klein. He talks to Kyle Chaika, who in February will have a book out called Filter World, How Algorithms Flatten culture. And it was a very interesting conversation they had. And the thing is that, you know, it's like culture and interaction has changed a lot because of technology. And they talk about how, like, in the past, we needed to socialize to get feedback about music and see what we liked in terms of music. So they refer to, they talk about Spotify and how much more exposed we are to different kinds of musics, and we are able to choose music more to our liking on our own, because these apps, they keep a record of our preferences and what we like, instead of having to get references from other people. And Ezra, he's the one who's basically talking about Spotify and how he was able to find some music that he's just enjoying so much. I think his podcast started asking Chaikia what taste is. And they go into an interesting conversation about how, you know, it's something on the inside that we're very comfortable knowing who we are, and being able to find something on the outside that resonates with who we are, and that is taste, and that is like, instead of what we read or what we eat or what we listen to, it's more of an identity of being in touch of who we are, of how we feel, of how we are evolving, and of how we are interacting with the world, being aware of how we interact with the world and what things outside of us match up with that behavior and that way of being and who we are. Okay, so it was an interesting conversation. Then the following day, I did a comment on the Mayim Bialik conversation with Rob Thomas of Matchbox 20. I mentioned that it was sort of interesting that a couple of weeks ago I saw him on a clip, social media clip, where someone was interviewing him, and the person who was interviewing him had no idea whatsoever who Rob Thomas was. But sometimes I wonder how much of a setup it is, you know, just to get people out on social media, because now I see Rob Thomas on a podcast and I was like, this is just too much coincidence. I mean, I haven't heard of him for the longest time. And then during the podcast, I realized, so this is it. He's back on the radar, per se, because I haven't seen the movie Barbie, but apparently Ken's favorite song, or his song, is Push, which is a song from, you know, from Rob Thomas and or Matchbox 20. And so I mentioned that it's sort of like Sophie Ellie Braxton, who's on the radar again with her song Murder on the Dance Floor, because the main character of the movie Saltburn does, like, he dances naked at the end of the movie, dances throughout the entire mansion to her song Murder on the Dance Floor. And so Murder on the Dance Floor is now like on the radar. And it's sort of the same thing with Rob Thomas, his song being part of the Barbie movie, which was highly popular, you know, brings him back on the stage, back on the radar. So maybe that's why I see him now on social media and on these interviews. But it was a wonderful talk. He was, he talks about how he had a strained relationship with his dad. He was born on a military base in Germany, and he says that the only good thing he got from his dad was to stay away from the military. But I say, I mean, I'm from Panama, and we had the military bases here from the Panama Canal. And I've met several people from the Canal Zone born in military bases, and they're all very happy with their lives and how everything turned out. I mean, it's sort of, for me, it's a bit of a contradiction to hear someone say, stay away from the military, when what I've seen is so many people happy with their lives as people born in military bases. It was a privilege. And I can say that many people from this country have benefited from the relationship with the people with the bases. So I don't know, but it was an interesting talk. And he also talks about how his career got started. He had a demo tape and he had a little band, and they used to go, they were performing in little clubs. But somehow when Carlos Santana was about to, they were working on that song called Smooth from the album Supernatural, and they needed someone to work on the lyrics, and they got Rob Thomas to take a look at it, and somehow there was some connection there. And they sent a demo of Rob Thomas to Carlos Santana, who heard him, and he's like, hey, this guy, can we get him to sing? And it seems the demo tape was so good that Carlos Santana says, you know, we should get him on board. Let's get him to do this. And I think we've all heard the song Smooth. It's a fantastic song, a bit corny. I don't know. It's a bizarre little sticky rhythm that can get a little, it can be a little too much at times. In Spanish, we say empalagoso, when something is like, you know, when you have too much sugar and you're like, I've had enough sugar, that I've been, what's the word? I don't know. You know what I'm talking about. Empachao. Okay. So that was a neat interview as well. And then on the next day, I do a talk about Michael Shermer talking to Michael Schellenberger. And it's just a little funny that Michael Shermer is talking to Michael Schellenberger. It's just so, those names are just too similar. They're different, but too similar. I don't know. It's just funny. But it was a great conversation, because Michael Schellenberger is a journalist, and he's one of the few who was invited to take a look at the Twitter files. And he's a Democrat, and I guess he leans a little bit to the left, so he must be like center left, but he's a Democrat. Well, you know, Democrats seem to be a little center left. And what he says is that he's lost many friendships over how he's changed his stance on how he thinks about what happened with Trump and so many other things. The interview is very much focused on the First Amendment and how important it is for the United States and its society. And it's, you know, he says this, that the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom to report, freedom to gather peacefully, but to gather in groups and to express opinions and points of views is in front of the right to bear arms. It's in front of all other amendments. It's so valued to be able to express your opinions. And they say something like, in the past, you know, to be able to say something, an opinion to the king, you needed to ask permission to the king, who would say like, well, you can this time say something and let me know what you think, but just be careful of what you're going to say. And, you know, that they left that all behind, and they valued and protected this freedom of speech throughout the history of the United States. And he was shocked to see how through the Twitter files he could see censorship of people who had opposing views and opposing opinions being censored by the government. And he's saying this is just so anti-United States, is so against the First Amendment. To have a renowned professor from Stanford say that he believes that the best way to handle the COVID pandemic is to focus on protecting the elderly, the babies, and those who have existing preconditions that make them vulnerable to being infected, instead of locking everyone up, instead of a lockdown, instead of shutting the economy. And so when he expressed this, he was censored just for saying something that went against what was going to be done. And people have a right, especially in the United States, they value this right so much. How can the government censor someone going against what makes one of the things that gives a solid base to one of the greatest countries and cultures in the world? A powerhouse, a beacon of light in the world that has this as one of its core values, to protect freedom of speech. How can they censor someone for just saying, for using their freedom, which is guaranteed by the amendments and the laws of the United States? They're guaranteed to be able to freely express their opinion. How can they be censored by the government? And to me, I love everything that has to do with the United States. I think the United States is one of the greatest countries throughout all of history. And it sort of hurts to see so much conflict going on within the United States. He also says that he's changed his stance on Trump. And again, I will leave the link if you want to listen to that conversation, which is very interesting. And then I finally end the week with summaries of the Naval Ravikant conversation with David Dutch. Two brilliant human beings. It's just a fascinating conversation. They do talk a lot about ChatGPT. And what they say, both of them agree, is that ChatGPT comes up short. They find it hard to believe that people are sort of scared of ChatGPT, or they find it hard to believe that people see ChatGPT as a human when they see so many flaws on when they work with ChatGPT. They're like, come on. You know, Naval Ravikant says that when he knows a subject so well, he can see how ChatGPT is unable to make a good summary or to abbreviate the concept to its core, because he will leave out key points and key references to be able to express the point correctly, or the subject matter. It takes out things it should leave in the summary of the subject matter. And then David Dutch goes on to explain that he used an add-on called DALL-E to make an image of Socrates and Plato with friends. And he told ChatGPT to make a photorealistic image of Socrates with Plato and his friends. And he came up with a black and white image. And so David went on to modify and to keep asking for modifications. He says, look, yes, this is good, but I want it to be in color. And I need Socrates to be down on the level with everybody, and for Plato to be taller. And because Plato is a wrestler and a large person. He says that Plato means Platon, which is a nickname for someone. If someone's a wrestler and you have a nickname for him, which is Platon, it means that you're like wide-chested, broad-shouldered. So he was a big guy, and he says that he puts two and two together. So he must be like a big guy, wrestler, strong. So what happened when he gave these new instructions to ChatGPT? ChatGPT kept Socrates as the taller one, took the shirt off Plato, and now showed him all like fit and muscular, but still shorter than Socrates. And he said that it was so difficult to move forward because he's like, you know, if I talk to any artist, it would be very easy to tell them, put a shirt back on Plato and make him taller. And he was unable to work with ChatGPT to make that change. ChatGPT never put a shirt back on Plato and never made him taller and never brought Socrates back down. So he says, you know, if you talk to any human artist, they would rapidly understand the request and be able to work with it. But ChatGPT is unable to do that. And what they're saying is that some people see these behaviors or these glitches on how ChatGPT works as creativity. And they go on in a conversation discussing the subject of creativity, which brought me back into my college days when I had to read The Unknown Craftsman and how wonderful it was to open my mind to new possibilities and see the world and appreciate beauty in a different way. Because for me, anything that was ceramic had to be shiny, sort of crystal-like. And when I spent time with this art in college and my professor exposed me to raku or reduction firing or wood ash firing, and I was able to appreciate earth tones and mate tones and sort of more rustic views, you know, it's amazing also how we can make something that's utilitarian but beautiful at the same time and work with the concepts of utilitarian and just things that are purely aesthetic and sculptural and maybe mix them both. So I had a really great time listening to that conversation about what creativity is. They also mentioned that some people have the idea that creativity is being able to grab existing things and put them together to form something else. And that's just one aspect. But people are really focused on that because I think it was Steve Jobs, they say, who sort of brought this concept of putting different things together to create something different or something new. But creativity really goes beyond that. And it's a lot. It's defining creativity would limit what creativity means or is. Anyway, this is the end of the summary for the week. I hope you've enjoyed it, and we'll meet again on the right side of zero. Be well, and thank you very much.